from stpetecatalyst.com.
Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And so often, Craig, we start these episodes with bummer news about environmental degradation and conservation losses in Florida. But this week, the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com, you've got a success. So let's bask in it together.
Sure, sure. Well, it's that's why I wanted to tell the story, is because so often these fights all over the state end in, you know, developers triumphant, miners triumphant, Florida nature that makes this place so special, you know, being wiped out. Mm-hmm. This one, all the little Davids got together and beat the Goliath. Folks were upset that when they heard that these well-known, well-established ranchers and landowners in Union and Bradford County were going to be building a phosphate mine there. And so they all got together and convinced the Union County commissioners to basically slow everything down. And then meanwhile in Bradford County, they put up a real strong fight. And after 7 years, last week, the would-be miners waved the white flag and said, "We're not going to do it." And they've dissolved the company and withdrawn their permit application.
Yeah, and this was 7,500 acres of a phosphate mine over, you know, the aquifer and fresh water sources. It would have, of course,
New River.
Yep. Totally disastrous on any number of levels. We're talking about an area north of Gainesville here. And, you know, it struck me again, 7 years, that's what it took. And individually, countless hours, exhausting work, going to meetings, writing emails, badgering council people, individual activists, community activism. Yeah. If you want to stop development in Florida, boy, as tough as it is, you kind of have to make it your life, because and it may take 7 years, but God bless these people. They did it.
Yeah, they did. And it was interesting to me that, you know, some of them were folks who were who had moved there in retirement. They were retired folks from Miami or from Tampa. But other folks, the one woman who kind of sparked the whole thing was a lifelong resident of Union County and realized this thing was going to go right next door to her. Mm-hmm. And she showed the map. She went to her county commissioner and got him to show her on a map where it was going to be, showed her son, a fisheries biologist. And he was like, no, this is going to be really bad for you. It's going to be bad for the New River. It's going to be bad for the Santa Fe River that the New River flows into. And so it galvanized her to start calling people, setting up meetings. They'd be out there in front of the grocery store on Saturday mornings or in front of the dollar store, recruiting people to help out. They had bumper stickers. They had flyers that they mailed out. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, you name it. And they were reaching out to the public to let people know, hey, this is coming. These people think they're entitled to do this, and it's going to be disastrous, and we have to band together to stop them. Yeah. And it worked.
Successful grassroots community activism and organizing, a great story there to cleanse your palate from all the losses. FloridaPhoenix.com, a success story in Florida conservation. Well, here's a story that should get a lot more attention than it does, because it has to do with one of the most famous authors ever, one of the most famous people ever, Harriet Beecher mm-hmm. Stowe, and her connection to Florida's early tourism.
Yeah, she's famous for writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, which some people say actually started the Civil War. And she became, you know, basically one of the most famous women, one of the most famous people in America. After the Civil War ended, she came to Florida and just fell in love with the place and wrote these stories about how much she loved it, how beautiful mm-hmm. it was, and said, come on down, you know, come down here and enjoy this beautiful state, and sort of kickstarted our whole tourism industry.
Yeah. Our guest today is John Foster. He's the author of a number of books about early Florida tourism. And by early, we're talking 1860s and 1870s early Florida tourism, and Harriet Beecher Stowe's connection to it. He's the professor emeritus in anthropology at Florida A&M University, and he joins us for this episode.
Thank you so much for joining us today. What led you to get interested in the subject of Harriet Beecher Stowe in Florida?
To get to her, I started from other people in Reconstruction. We started with John Sanford Swaim in Jacksonville because we had his diary, which was very unusual. Hmm. He was an older Northern Methodist minister who came to Jacksonville during the Civil War, partly because his health was poor. But he then served primarily with the Black troops there. What made his diary unusual is that he in no way ever put down denigrated people of color in any way. Now, he didn't use the N-word ever. He didn't use the D-word ever. Mm-hmm. Even though other people did, he did not. And we have his diary for an entire year, which was 1866. But it presented us a puzzle because he flat said on two occasions he was writing things for a newspaper in New Jersey, the Sentinel of Freedom. And so we managed to get copies of that for the entire Reconstruction. And lo and behold, he wrote 10 or 11 articles starting in 1865 and running to about 1869.
And was he touting Florida as a good location? Was he inviting people to come down to visit?
Yes. These things at times read like something from the Chamber of Commerce. He is flat out going for people.
What was his argument? What was his pitch?
A variety of different things. The climate, the types of plants that could grow here, and the seasons and the ability to grow things in the winter. He talked about growing tomatoes and I think getting $8 a bushel, which is a tremendous amount of money. Mm-hmm. So he mentions at times citrus and the potentials there. He's trying to get people to come to, in fact, settle here. And I didn't realize at the time or my wife that this was part of a project of a group of people that began before the Civil War. At the center of this project was Edward Everett Hale, but participants included William Cullen Bryant, who was a noted poet and editor at the time. Harriet Beecher Stowe's husband was a member of this organization. It was called a New England Immigrant Aid Company, or more simply, just the Immigrant Aid Company. And they had a focus, and the focus was on Kansas. And the issue that was really hot was, what was Kansas going to turn into? Was it going to become a slave state, or was it going to be a free state? And these people were determined that it was going to be a free state. And so they did everything they could think of to make it easy for people to go to Kansas in the 1850s. This included a variety of things that range from getting less expensive tickets to setting up a place to receive people coming in, to have a newspaper to record what was going on and to present it. And this was an effort, again, to get people to come. In fact, Kansas had very few people. We're talking about something less than probably 5,000 people. Other than, of course, Native Americans.
Yeah. Now, when they turned their focus to Florida after the Civil War in the late 1860s, they aren't just targeting anyone. They don't want Southerners to move here, correct? They are particularly interested in Northerners. You mentioned that New England was in their title. They want folks from up north to come to Florida, correct?
That's exactly right. They actually announced this program nationally in the Atlantic Monthly of February 1864. They're not even waiting till the end of the Civil War.
Wow.
And the idea is, if you wanted to create a place of freedom in the South, Florida is virtually empty. It had less than 190,000 residents in 1870 in its census.
And the people who are here are pretty well spread out, too.
Particularly along the border with Georgia. That's where most of the population is. Keep in mind, too, that it's almost evenly half Black and half white. So it doesn't take many newcomers to, in fact, create a place that could be run on democracy. So one of the things that John Swaim said in his articles that we found early is, let's settle them out. Let's have Kansas and Nebraska come over them. In other words, they want to, in fact, create a place of freedom. And the idea is to get people to come here.
Mm-hmm. How did Harriet Beecher Stowe wind up down here? She came after the Civil War, right?
That's exactly right. The first visit was in 1867. And working with some other people at the Stowe Center, We as a team found Harriet Beecher Stowe's first published articles about Florida. We found five of them roughly in 2012. But we have and found her first account of coming to Florida.
Was she coming here as a tourist herself that first time?
No. One of the things that people don't realize is that she had a group of family here during the Civil War. Hmm. There are plenty of places in the South that many people would have been happy to kill her. All right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And
she could have had
Nancy, because of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She could have had Nancy Pelosi's experience if they caught her on January 6th.
Yeah.
There would be plenty of Southerners who would have been happy to kill her. And so she can't just go anywhere in the South. But she had two first cousins in Fernandina in 1863. She had her half-sister, Isabella, visit after the Battle of Olustee in 64. She has the cousin's husband was here for part of the Civil War. He was at the Battle of Olustee. So in other words, she's got relatives spending real time in Florida. So she has some real clues as to exactly what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. Small as a person, very slight in build. And she suffered in the winters in New England. And she particularly hated the cold blasts that occasionally happened in March and April. That was a brutal experience to her.
I lived in Connecticut for 4 years. I feel you. That's winter's overtime. And it's supposed to be spring and it's more winter. You make a good point. You know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which she wrote, was kind of a lighted match in the tinderbox of slavery in America to incite the Civil War. She is incredibly famous.
Well, people need to realize that Uncle Tom's Cabin, she began with the ending of it. And that is when Uncle Tom is protecting two women who are running away. He knows where they are. He's confronted by a brutal, horrific slave owner, Simon Legree. And Simon confronts Uncle Tom. Do you know where they are? And Uncle Tom says, yes. And he says, what are you going to do about it? And some of the last words that Uncle Tom says is, I can die, which represents a basic truth about slavery, that you can have a decent, honest, real Christian killed by a brutal, worthless slave owner and have the slave owner suffer no consequences. Mm-hmm. So in spite of the book's shortcomings, it ends with a powerful revelation about the horrific nature of slavery. One thing I want to clarify on this real fast is that people know she was famous in this country. What they don't realize is that she was world famous. When she died in 1896, her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, had been translated into 22 different languages.
Wow, that's amazing.
You could guess what some of them are, but could you guess, let me get this list here, that it included Armenian, Danish, Finnish, Illyrian, Japanese,
wow,
Polish, Portuguese, Serbian, Swedish, Wallachian, Hebrew, and Hindustani. So, gentlemen, what is Wallachian? I'm probably mispronouncing.
I have no idea.
I was clueless, too. I believe that is a language in Romania.
So she didn't like the cold weather up north. She's got family in Florida. So where did she move to in Florida?
Well, she and her brother came to Jacksonville in 1867. Her son, who had suffered during the war and was having problems with alcohol, was staying on a cotton plantation south of what's now Riverside in Jacksonville. She was hoping he would get his life straight. And the honest truth is, he didn't. Mm-hmm. And while she was there, she went across the river to Mandarin to get the mail, and she fell in love with it in the orange grove there instantly. And her response was, send the money, do it now, need to buy this place immediately.
Now, what is Mandarin? Where is that?
This is a village then, very tiny, approximately 12, 14 miles south of the downtown Jacksonville. Now, if you're going around Jacksonville and the south side, like a lot of people do on the Buckman Bridge, going on the bypass, let's assume you're going towards Daytona. You cross the Buckman Bridge, which is like 6 or 8 lanes wide. And if you're coming down on the east side and look off to the south, you will see a very sizable point of land. You are looking at Mandarin.
Is it anything? I take it it's nothing like it was back in her day.
Well, with the Buckman Bridge, now you can be working in downtown and live in the area. So when I used to see it in the 50s and 60s, it was a tiny village. It is a monstrous suburb now.
Yeah, there's no distinguishing Mandarin, Craig, anymore from any other neighborhood in Jacksonville. It's completely sprawled over, covered over with streets, roads, convenience stores, homes, anything. You know, it's not like Mandarin starts here and then, you know, it looks very much different in the next neighborhood. It's totally covered up. You would have no way of distinguishing unless you grew up there and went to the local elementary school. Oh, that's Mandarin versus that's Riverside or that's any other neighborhood. You know, as near as I can tell from working in Jacksonville for 10 years, nothing really distinguishes Mandarin from anywhere else on that part of town.
So what was it that so bewitched her about Mandarin?
The orange grove. She bought a piece of land with, I want to say, 40 acres of orange groves, most of which had been planted in the early part of the 19th century. And there's a horrific freeze in the middle of the 1830s that killed all the trees, and they came back from the roots. And that's what she's looking at 40 years later. Hmm. March 30 of this year brings the 150th anniversary of the publication of Palmetto Leaves. March this year, end of March. Mm-hmm. And this is Harriet Beecher Stowe's book about Florida, and it led to a significant, actually a dramatic change in tourism. So if you were to pick up the book, what would you find? You would find many, many accounts of the weather. And these are not all based on just BS. On the contrary, she's being very honest that the winters bring at times frost and occasionally really deadly frost. So you come to Florida, bring a heavy coat, be prepared to find a place. And if you're here in the winter, by all means, look for a place that has a fireplace. Second piece of advice that's worth noting is that people were coming to Florida expecting to find flowers everywhere. And she will be first in line to say that's not true. There are plenty of places where there are pine trees and pine barrens and sandy soil. But if you want to find the flowers, you need to find the brooks and the branches. So every 2 or 3 miles, our path is traversed by a brook, and the finest trees and shrubbery grow upon its banks. This is where you could find pale pink azaleas that fill the air with sweetness. So you need to be looking at the branches and the creeks. It's not all of this territory. She makes trips by boat. This is the way tourists did things primarily. The railroads were a ways in coming. And there were a few. You could go from Jacksonville over to Tallahassee, or you could go to Baldwin and catch a train that would take you to Fernandina or Cedar Key. But that's about the end of the railroad. So she's out doing boats. A lot of it sailing in the neighborhood, going up Julington Creek, going up the river. She makes a 130-mile trip by boat going down to what was Enterprise, a largely forgotten place. But she said on the way back, she saw some charming scenery. It was the most wild, dreamlike, enchanting sail conceivable. When she thinks of Florida, she thinks of Florida as having two sides, very much like a piece of embroidery. One side is beautiful, and that the other is all ragtag. Mm-hmm. Stowe says the best way to cope with it is to have two homes, the second one being a simple winter dwelling in the South.
It's the Craig Pittman plan, two houses. Why don't you just have one? What good is that?
You're lucky if you can even have one these days. Yeah.
So in the end, she says, and keep in mind, when you look at Harriet Beecher Stowe's writings, this woman is a significant amateur artist. And there are paintings that she left of magnolias and of oranges and orange trees. So when she starts looking, oh, by the way, she's also really a naturalist. So this is what she says about Florida. If we painted Florida, we would not represent her as a neat, trim damsel with starched lemon cuffs and collar. She would be a brunette, dark but comely, with gorgeous tissue, a general disarray and dazzle, and a sort of jolly untidiness, free, easy, and joyous.
Wow. You can kind of see why she made the state seem so appealing. And because of her fame, right? Anything she wrote instantly grabbed onto a lot of readers.
If you are looking, by the way, no one knows how many copies of Uncle Tom's Cabin were printed in the 19th century. But based on the number of translations, she wrote the most popular novel in the 19th century.
Amazing.
She had a status in the world different probably from anybody alive today. You need to be thinking of somebody like a Gandhi. Mm-hmm. That's the level she's at. So whatever she writes, somebody's going to take a look at it.
Yeah.
But let me talk about the impact of this.
Mm-hmm. Please do.
At the end of the Civil War, there was no facilities for tourism in Jacksonville at all. It had two hotels, and both of them had been destroyed. One burned before the war and the other one during it. So one person observed in 1869 that Jacksonville had been transformed by Northern money, and there were now two hotels there. And this proceeded, you know, four more being built very rapidly in the 1870s. So the tourism was estimated in 1869 at 2,000 strangers from the north. In a couple of years, the number grew to 14,000. And on October 11th, 1874, the New York Times reported that there were 50,000 visitors to Florida last season.
Wow.
This is a state that has hardly any people in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where are these people staying? Well, they are looking for houses that people put a sign in the window, bedroom for rent. Sort of starts like Airbnb or whatever it is.
Airbnb, yeah.
Now, this statement in the New York Times is actually confirmed by other newspapers. Christian Union would have said there were 40,000 visitors. But notice the date. This is October 1874, and her book, Palmetto Leaves, was out in spring of 73. So
now, almost instantaneous for that day and age.
Yeah.
Now, she is certainly a factor in this, probably the primary one. But there's also another person who would have been a factor in this as well, and that's William Cullen Bryant. He came forth with and edited a group of travel books called Picturesque America. And what made them so very exciting is that these things are highly illustrated. If I brought out my copy of Picturesque America, you'd say, well, that's a heavy, old-fashioned 19th century book. But the layout is not old. If you were going to, say, in the second chapter up the Ocklawaha, there would, in fact, be a number of illustrations of what the Ocklawaha exactly looked like, the swamps, the alligators, even a mailbox along the path, the steamboats on the Ocklawaha, and at last, Silver Springs. So in other words, if you're going to Paris tomorrow, you would have a book with the Eiffel Tower on one page as a color photo, and on the opposite is a written description. This is the way Picturesque America is set up.
Hmm.
And it first volume came out in 72. That's the year where Stowe was putting together and writing a series of articles, and that was what she would make Palmetto Leaves into.
I was going to ask you. So it's a, is it a collection of her periodical pieces? Yeah.
She normally wrote things as serials. She wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin as a serial. Most of her novels, if not all of them, are serials. Once it's all out, then she would combine it into a book.
How extensively did she travel throughout Florida?
Well, that's what I could get to. Palmetto Leaves covers her nearby river trips, going across the river to Green Cove Springs, to Magnolia on the other side. Way on up the river to Enterprise. She visits Palatka, but she does not visit Silver Springs, not in Palmetto Leaves. But when we get to this book calling the Yankees to Florida, this is a look at all of her publications about Florida. So it begins with her first account of seeing Florida, and it ends with a story about Native Americans told for children in 1881. So we go from Alpha to Omega, but we pick up some of her trips. One of them was to Silver Springs. That's a very finely written account. But she was afraid to go there until friends had gone there and said, it's wonderful and you're missing it, because she was turned off by the appearance of the boats that go there, which are all, she described it as like a coffin. These are books with heavy wooden sides, little windows. She was afraid of going on it. But she eventually does and has a really wonderful experience.
Were they glass-bottom boats at that point?
No. These are steamboats, but they are small, they are narrow, and they don't have big expanses of decks except up front. They don't have any of the hardly any glass windows. Yeah.
No shuffleboard, no buffets, no dinner shows, that kind of thing. It's exactly. Not a Carnival cruise line.
I have heard, I don't know if this is true, she herself became a tourist attraction for the boats?
That's exactly right. after Palmetto Leaves, the people want to get a look at her, and she didn't hide in Mandarin. She would come out when the boats were scheduled to come by and stand there and with Times her daughter. Daughters, I should say.
Just wave at the crowds as they sail by.
She herself was a tourist. They eventually built a new pier for the boats to come to. And then people would go all over their property looking for her like she's a tourist attraction. And one of the stories is that a woman or two came upon her Stowe's husband, and they expressed their disappointment in seeing him and not her. And his response was, well, he was disappointed that she wasn't there and that he was. That's the drift of it.
How funny.
How long did she live in Florida for?
She came here in the winters.
Okay.
That started in 1867, and she didn't stop to 1884. And she did every winter. And what ended it was that Calvin Stowe's health particularly had kidney problems. And he couldn't make the trip. And so she only lived another year or two. But he never came back, and neither did she.
Now, her brother had a pretty profound impact on Florida, too, didn't he?
If you're talking about Charles Beecher, the answer is yes.
Yes.
And so when you get to my books, you will find that Charles is frequently in them. And I've even written a new paper for the Florida Historical Quarterly about his life in Wakulla County, which is a rural county, Piney Woods, directly south from Tallahassee. And he lived there most of the time from 1869 till his family, their health started collapsing in multiple dimensions in the mid-1880s. But he is and was, for half of Harrison Reed's administration, the superintendent of education in the state of Florida. And he left a very positive track record. For one thing, he believed that education needed to be popularized for all of Florida's citizens. At the end of the Civil War, the primary schools in Florida that existed had been established by charities for African Americans and their children. And so public education at that point in time was focused on Blacks. And the Reeds, and particularly the governor's wife, Chloe Merrick Reed, were afraid that if Reconstruction ended too fast, then the white citizens would just destroy the schools. So they need to popularize the schools. And how Charles Beecher did this was to apply the idea that of civil service. If you were interested in schools and had a track record that was positive, then he could appoint you to being the superintendent of schools for a county. And he did so without any political bias. And so suddenly then schools are becoming very popular. And in fact, popular is to say the least. So if you have at the end of the 19th century and you're looking at literacy, not illiteracy, you would find that Florida's population, even though it was the poorest, least populated southern state, had a rate of literacy higher than almost all of the old the states of the old Confederacy. The exceptions, I think, are Texas and I want to say Tennessee or Kentucky.
And he set up the school system we have today, the public school system, right?
That's exactly right. The school system we have today dates from laws passed under Harrison Reed, obviously with the approval of Mrs. Reed, that set up county school systems. And so the system we have today began in 1869. Now you may say, what was here before then? And the answer is virtually nothing. Wealthy people could establish a school for their family or their friends. The state appropriated like 10 cents per student in the state per year for public education before the Civil War. In other words, they spent no money on education and probably wrote a few checks to a few teachers that had private schools. That was it. So our system goes back to the Reeds and it goes back to Charles Beecher, who publicized it. And so if you want to know some of the things that Charles did, is he left a recommendation that said the biggest shortcoming in Florida's education is the inability of students to have textbooks. Many of them were too poor to have textbooks, and their parents could not buy them. So he said the answer is the state needs to buy books for students and loan them to students based on them being kept in good condition and return at the end of the loan. This was endorsed by one superintendent of public instruction in Florida after another. It would be the 1920s before a governor would actually implement this.
So he was very foresighted and very organized, clearly.
Right. And he made a difference. The schools became popular. And I want to say by roughly 1880, 75% of all kids in Florida were going to school.
Amazing.
You mentioned Chloe Merrick Reed, and in reading some of the reviews for your book, her name came up, and that's not a name that's popped up in the 140 episodes or so of the podcast. Real quick, you mentioned that she was the governor's wife. What was her role and kind of her position at this time in Florida?
Well, you were asking, how did we get to Stowe? We start with John Swain, who's a member of this organization, okay? Then we started looking at the people he knew and who shows up in his diary. Perhaps the most common and frequent name is Harrison Reed, but then occasionally Chloe Merrick shows up. Chloe Merrick was a teacher in her early 30s, and they needed people to help with Black families around federal military bases. And so she came to Fernandina because the federal government had the garrison there almost from the beginning of the war. And so there were plenty of people of color that were nearby and with federal troops became free. But what was going to happen to these children? What was going to be happening to these women? Some of the men, many of them actually enlist in the federal army. So what's going to happen to these people? Well, the army doesn't want to have the responsibility of looking out for them. So it was a real outreach to abolitionists in the North. And Chloe Merrick came to Fernandina. She taught in a school there with another woman. And then she soon realized that there were plenty of children that were not being cared for properly because they had no parents. And so she sets up an orphanage. Now, she's doing this, and she's roughly 31 or 32. One of the people in Fernandina was a tax collector by the name of Harrison Reed, who's a full generation older than Chloe Merrick. And he helps her. He endorses her in letters sent to newspapers in Syracuse. Syracuse is where Chloe was from. That's where she goes back to raise money in the summers for her orphanage. And Harrison Reed says she's fully competent to do anything that this thing requires. So here he is endorsing her. Later, all of this falls all apart when Andrew Johnson returns property to wealthy Southerners, and the orphanage property goes back to its original owner. The orphanage eventually comes unglued. Chloe gets sick and then goes off to teach in North Carolina. But once he becomes governor, Harrison Reed, who has obviously been interacting with her by mail, even had an easy way to do it. His personal secretary was Chloe's nephew. Would you believe a teenager? Charles Kinney was a teenager, and Harrison Reed had him as his personal secretary. Well, Harrison Reed proposes to Chloe, and I'm sure it's based on the knowledge that she wants to implement social programs, and he is happy for that to happen. He's busy in one political struggle after another, some with Southerners, but some with other political factions in the Republican Party. So he goes from one crazy impeachment to another, but he ends up remaining in office. And a fella in the 1950s said that Chloe planned the social outreach, the social programs of her husband's administration. Can you believe that?
Fascinating. Fascinating.
So my wife and I, went to Syracuse. We found that their historical society had files on her older brothers, all of which, one was 20 years older, one of them was 18 years older, a file on her father, but they did not have a file on her. Well, let me assure you, they do now.
I'll bet. It's just we did a show on Mayman Jennings. It's just amazing to me how these women who were married to governors were very influential and made such a big mark in spite of not being able to vote.
Part of the motivation for Chloe is there was a big event in Syracuse roughly around 1850, 1851. A man who was a runaway slave was in Syracuse, and people came to apprehend him. Now, this is an abolitionist center, and let me assure you, the local people didn't go along with this. So they free this black man not once, but twice. And in the first episode, Chloe's father, the man is basically given a signal in a courtroom to run. And he goes out the door, and Chloe's father slams the door and holds it closed. So her own father was a wanted man for more than a year.
Wow.
What is the Stowe Center?
Stowe Center is in West Hartford. It has incredible archives. It has been growing from things in the 19th century. What's really, I think, fascinating is think of a corner and on the main street and then the side immediately interior, the first lot on the interior side of the corner, is where the Stowe's house was, their last one in Hartford. That's the center. Now, if you go back to that corner and go down the main street one lot, that is, in fact, Mark Twain's house.
Wow.
Can you imagine these two famous authors, Samuel Clemens and Harriet Beecher Stowe, being neighbors?
That's amazing.
And I'm not talking about neighbors a mile apart. We're talking around the corner.
So is there anything left in Florida, that Harriet Beecher Stowe was part of or lived in or anything like that? Or is it all gone now?
The house in Mandarin was taken down more than a century ago. There is a museum in Mandarin, and it's focused on a variety of things, including Harriet Beecher Stowe. And the school building there has been there. Stowe wanted a school for the kids in Mandarin, both black and white. One was built, and then somehow it burned down under unknown circumstances. Mm-hmm. So she, in fact, encouraged the building of a second one. That's still standing.
But her home's gone. Her home in Tallahassee, is that gone as well, I assume?
Well, she didn't have a home in Tallahassee.
Oh, okay.
Her brother, Charles, had a house down in Newport, which is a tiny little place, a spot on the map in Wakulla County. But I have an article from 1936 or 37 that shows a photo of that house. So it lasted well into the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's standing now.
So if anyone wanted to be a tourist and go look for signs of Harriet Beecher Stowe, they'd have to go to that one museum in Mandarin, I guess.
That to me, that you would see things there. You see a variety of other things there. There was a sizable steamboat that was sunk in the Civil War. There are lots of parts of it and things related to it. There was also a member of the community who died service in World War I. He's featured there, and they have a book about him. Don't go out looking for a lot of history books in Florida to talk about Stowe a lot, some of which big ones don't even mention her at all. But there's a basic lie, a basic flaw in the history of tourism in the state. Now, let me clarify what that is, because let me assure you, our first book, Beecher Stowe's and Yankee Strangers, was regarded by historians as, well, that's just an account of meaningless things. That's not true, because they have worked in this state with what's known as the 1880 hypothesis. This appeared in writing by Gary Mormino in the Florida Handbook, roughly in 1989 or 90, and it was cited many times. This is what Mormino says. Tourism came to Florida in three periods of change: the 1880s, the 1890s, and post-World War II decades. Tourism prior to 1880 was difficult, expensive, and time-consuming. Henry Flagler and Henry Plant, acting as if the Pope had demarcated the peninsula, inaugurated a vigorous era of railroad building. It's true that they built railroads like crazy, building fancy hotels, but what people don't realize is the tourists were already here before Henry Flagler ever saw Florida. And there was a grand hotel in Jacksonville called the St. James. It appeared in 1869, was added to twice. It could accommodate 500 guests. So if you want a hotel with, hey, try running water, a hotel with real bathrooms, try a bowling alley, try a deluxe dining room. This place is set up for it. Mm-hmm. And what Stowe says, if you want to come to Florida and really grow from the experience, is don't sit in the St. James Hotel. Don't just sit there in steamboats. You need to get out and move around. You need to explore Florida, and you need to be physically moving in it. Her advice is just as good today as it was then. If you're going to really enjoy the winter in Florida, you need to be outside enjoying it.
Yeah.
She would say the people who made the most out of winters in Florida were, in fact, children. And they were out there doing it, moving around.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So I'd take the 1880 hypothesis And I started working on it in an article in about Stowe's original publications about Florida. This appeared in the 2017 Florida Historical Quarterly. And what I point out is that the historians in the state miss what's going on with tour books. Picturesque America was immensely popular for decades in the 19th century, and they brought up multiple versions of it. But keep in mind, it's highly illustrated, and with professional artists doing the drawings. And so if you're a historian and you're looking at tourism, why aren't you looking at the tour books? Well, they didn't. They also don't pay attention to the newspapers. There are all kinds of things in the newspapers in the North documenting vast numbers of people in Florida in the 1870s. Keep in mind, too, this is during one of the major depressions of the 19th century. Depressions that started roughly in 73 and went on and off throughout the rest of the decade. Hotels were built in Jacksonville during the Depression, four of them, to accommodate the tourists. Most famous magazine in the last half of the 19th century was Harper's New Monthly. This was basically standard reading in middle class and upper middle class houses in the United States. Harper's featured Florida seven times before 1872.
Wow.
But they're not alone. Scribner's featured Florida at times. So did other places. Applegate's did as well. So when I was talking about Harriet Beecher Stowe having a serial, and this was in the Christian Union. The Christian Union was run by her brother, Henry Ward Beecher. When the woman, Debbie Applegate, wrote a book about Henry Ward Beecher, she said he was the most popular man in America. Or actually, I said the most famous man in America. Well, his newspaper featured his sermons. It ran his wife's ideas about housekeeping and home ec. It published Stowe's husband's stuff about theology in the New Testament. It published whatever Harriet Beecher Stowe sent to the Christian Union. The Christian Union at one point had a circulation, a printing of 133,000 issues.
Wow.
1 week. This is in New York City, and it's going out to wealthy people and middle-class people. So they wanted to read what Henry Ward Beecher was saying. And there you have not just a small newspaper, but a real big one.
Yeah.
They wonder, well, why? But what Henry Ward Beecher was famous for is he rejected his father's theology. Lyman Beecher was big on old-fashioned Puritan nonsense. And that turned most of his sons off. That turned off Charles Beecher. It turned off Henry Ward Beecher. So the last thing these people wanted to do was to become a minister and do what their father did and oppress people. So what was Henry Ward? Henry Ward found faith on a spring or summer day out in a field. And he realized that God and Jesus loved us as we were, even as sinners. So this is one of the first ministers who is incredibly positive, who believes in affirming people and encourage them to do better, but not persecuting them when they do wrong.
He was the Norman Vincent Peale of his day.
Right. He's one of the first feel-good ministers in the United States ever.
John Foster has been our guest, author, historian, professor emeritus in anthropology at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. Thanks for sharing so much of your knowledge about Harriet Beecher Stowe and her influence on early tourism in Florida with us today, John.
I listened to your podcast dealing with Edward Ball, and I really liked it, but I didn't get quite to the end. Did you guys ever deal with the bulletproof doors?
No, I don't think so.
Well, my grandfather was a very talented artist and painter. And he was in the 1920s and 30s painting on these elaborate homes. And so he was out there at the house that Ed Ball and his sister lived in. And he told me that they had bulletproof doors on that house. So I shared that with a neighbor who, in fact, was supervising the state's inn at Wakulla Springs. Mm-hmm. And you know what he said?
What?
He has bulletproof doors on his apartment. And so I went down there to see it. Mm-hmm. And that door to his apartment complex, wood planks, and in the middle of it is a sheet of iron or steel, approximately a quarter of an inch thick. And the guy who was the supervisor said to work on the door and to do the hinges, it took four men to get it down.
Wow.
Now, when you look at the windows, you have these elaborate iron decoration features. They're not there just attached to the walls. They were mounted and poured concrete. So if you decided to go up there and you're going to break into that apartment where Ed Ball was, and you're going to just knock holes in it and go through the windows. Friend, you aren't going through those windows.
Yeah.
Any more than you're going through a bank wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it says a lot about a person if you need bulletproof accommodations.
Yeah.
That's good stuff, John. Thank you very much. Enjoy your day.
Hey, guys, thank you. I can't say thank you enough, gentlemen.
That's amazing, Craig. A funny story there about Ed Ball. You can find that in the archives. But going back to Harriet Beecher Stowe and Chloe Merrick Reed, I've lived in Fernandina for over 10 years. I have never heard either of those names in any context associated with Fernandina Beach, which astonishes me. You know, Harriet Beecher Stowe, arguably the most famous woman in the world while she lived.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are just so many Florida stories that people just don't even know about the people who have passed through here, who the great influence they've had.
And I tell you, Craig, does this ever have resonance with what's going on in Florida education today and the outlawing of African-American history? And it's such a shame because so much of that has to deal with Florida. It's not African-American history. It's not just American history. It's Florida history. I was just jotting this down while John was talking. The first civil rights martyrs, Mary McLeod Bethune, American Beach, Zora Neale Hurston, Martin Luther King Jr., Andrew Young, Augusta Savage, Jackie Robinson integrating baseball at Dodgertown and Vero Beach, mm-hmm. the Chitlin Circuit, Ray Charles, the Highwaymen. Most of these topics we've done episodes on, but that's all Florida history. That all happened in Florida. That didn't happen in Jackson, Mississippi, or Birmingham, Alabama, or Newark, New Jersey. That all happened in Florida. And if for no other reason, that's why that history should be taught in Florida schools, whether they're black or green or anything else, but especially because all of those incredibly significant monumental figures in American history connected with Florida history. And for the governor and his right-wing cronies to outlaw those stories just takes, it leaves a giant empty hole in American history and it makes it propaganda.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.
From stpetecatalyst.com.